I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, today is the first day of early voting in the two-party political primaries. There are Republicans and Democrats competing against each other to see who gets their party's nomination, and then they'll be able to run in the November election. If you consider yourself a political independent and then you aren't concerned with partisan politics, well, that doesn't mean that you should opt out of casting a vote. You still have a voice in this process, and you can vote in either primary. And there's a lot on the line. Your life is impacted by the outcome. Scott Braddock is with us today to break down the big races on the statewide ballot. For the U.S. Senate seat, things have gotten messy for both parties. How is that shaking out? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source. But first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
That car you've had for a while, the one that's getting expensive to maintain, have you considered donating it? Visit tpr.careasy.org to get started. Proceeds benefit Texas Public Radio.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Early voting is now underway in the Texas primary elections, and I can confirm that because I voted this morning at the Bexar County Courthouse. There was no line, but I hear there's a line now. Early voting continues through February 27th. Primary election day is March the 3rd. In Bexar County, Democrats will be picking who will be the nominee for Bexar County Judge, incumbent Peter Sakai or former Mayor Ron Nuremberg. That's a marquee race here locally, but we're going to be talking mainly about statewide stuff with Scott Braddock, the editor of the Quorum Report and host of Quorum Report Radio Podcast. And Scott, welcome back to The Source.
Always good to be here.
I want to, our number is, let me give the number, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you have a question, a comment, you want to weigh in on the primaries, give us a call. I want to hear what you got to say.
I like how you started by bragging that you went ahead and voted this morning. I haven't voted yet because I vote in Travis County. I was staying here in San Antonio last night. I'll do it as soon as I get back to Austin tomorrow.
I vote always first day.
I'm
first
with you. I like to knock it out.
Because I need to get, I love having these big yellow
get
sheets.
Get it out of your system.
These big yellow sheets. These are
my cheat
sheets. I know you can print it off on the internet, but this is the best thing.
Well, and you know what? One of the things that happens, you watch the pattern on early voting. Just watch it. This is consistent in Texas. The first two or three days of early voting is when you get a rush at the polls. Like you said, there's probably a line there now at the Bexar County Courthouse and some of the other places that you can vote. Same thing all over the state. And then there'll be a lull because we get basically 2 weeks. And, you know, a lot of Democrats have started to acknowledge, because for many years they would say, well, you know, Texas is a non-voting state and all of that. And I know what the arguments are, but if you look at the numbers, not really true the last couple of cycles, but you do have all these people voting. You have a long time to vote. So people will go vote those first 2 days, 24, 48, 72 hours, whatever. Then there's a lull. But if you wait until the end of early voting, then you get lines again. Mm-hmm. Because there are a bunch of people who then rush the polls because they don't want to have to vote on election day. So I'll probably go Wednesday, Thursday and have no line.
So to that point about voting numbers and things like that, and if it's a non-voting state or not, mm-hmm. I want to focus on the primary voting state. Now, looking at the 2022 March primary election, it was the last time we had a gubernatorial midterm election for the primary. We saw the number of Republican primary turnout voters was about 1.9 million voters. And the Democratic primary turnout was about 1 million voters, almost 2-1 Republican versus Democrats.
Sure.
Not really an indicator of, you know, the bigger picture, but more of like enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. But, you know, 2 million, 1 million, basically 3 million voting in the primary. The eligible voters that we have in Texas, registered voters at that time was 17 million.
Right.
So, and then, so people turn out in November and they say, I don't like any of them. Mm-hmm. So did you vote in the primary?
And they didn't.
And they didn't.
Of course.
And you wonder, but you see how the only election that really matters in Texas is the Republican primary.
Mr. Kronberg, my publisher at Quorum Report, and I have continued this tradition of saying, another way of what you're saying, is that the Republican primary in Texas is the election of consequence. I took it a little bit further to say that the GOP primary in Texas could be, I don't think this is hyperbolic at all, it could be the most important or consequential election on planet Earth that almost no one votes in, right? Because it, like you said, you're going to top out around 1.5, 2, maybe 3 million people who might participate in that process. And those people, you think about 3% of the population of Texas. We have 31 million people spread across 254 counties and two time zones. And if you think of it this way, a majority of the 1.5 million or so would be around 750,000, pushing up closer to a million. They get to decide the the leadership of the state and the policy prescriptions that those leaders will then pursue at the in Texas government. And until that changes, you're going to continue to see, you know, the kind of right-wing governance that we've had around here.
So essentially, 1 million people decide who runs Texas. And who are these 1 million people? These are the people that are the most diehard, the reddest of the red, dark red Republican voters.
Yeah.
And and that's because of this system that we have. And we have a lot of people who say, I'm a political independent. I don't want to vote in a primary because I'm an independent.
Right.
And I want to encourage everyone to vote in the political primary because this is you have a chance to have a voice. And I vote with good faith. Don't try to be a chaos maker, but vote for the candidates that you think best represent you. But at least vote. And then we have the same problem with people going too far on the left in the Democratic primary. And so I don't like the candidate in the who turns up on the ballot in November, the Democrat. They're too far left. Well then, why didn't you vote in the primary? Voted for that moderate.
Yeah, it's and I tell the story often. But my daughter, who is now 24 years old, when she was first eligible to vote, she was real excited. She was my little Bernie Sanders supporter. She was all about Bernie, and a lot of young people were. And she voted in Houston, and all of this is complicated. If people don't know about how all of these things work, it's really really easy for their voice to get lost, like you're saying. And so when Bernie lost that primary. We were getting, we vote as a family. We go to the same voting location and make our voting plan for everything and how we're going to go do that and when we're going to go do that. And when I started to tell her that, hey, it's time to vote again because the general election was coming up, her response was this. She goes, and my daughter's not stupid. She's brilliant. She goes, I voted already. Well, what she meant was she voted in the primary, but she didn't realize there's a whole nother election. I was telling some folks here in San Antonio yesterday that, maybe you could think of it like sports teams have a playoff system, right? I mean, right now, you've got the American League, the National League, the Republicans and the Democrats, if you group them that way, they play against each other. They have their playoffs. They figure out which team is going to advance to the World Series or the Super Bowl, whichever, analogy you want to use. And think of it this way. If you always had one team that never really participated in the first round of the playoffs and they went straight to the Super Bowl or straight to the World Series and they went up against the team that had been tested, what would happen? Well, the team that had been tested would always win. The tested team in Texas is the Republicans. So right now, you have all these, thin-skinned, Democrats who are clutching their pearls over how nasty their primary is. I'm kind of laughing at it because the Republican primaries are always nasty around here. And guess what? They always win in November, too.
They become battle-hardened.
That's it.
But I do also want to point out that we're the primary election on March 3rd. This is the earliest in the year that this is allowed. And that's done deliberately in order to air out the amount of time between the primary and the November election, really to keep people off guard. Mm-hmm. It's just one more way of keeping voters away from the polls.
Yeah.
The reason that we have so few people voting in the primaries is intentional, and we need to do more in order to elevate what is happening, the importance of this, the consequence of doing this, and it's really not that hard. And you can go do it. And if you don't know all the candidates, that's fine. Just vote for the ones that you recognize. You don't have to be an expert in every single race. Just go vote, particularly at the top of the ticket, because everything matters. It impacts your life, your family's life, the health and well-being of everyone in Texas. We just need more people to get out and vote in these political primaries. And with that, we're going to go to the break. When we come back, we're going to go into Scott's brain here and figure out what's happening with these high-profile races for the Texas U.S. Senate seat with Republicans and the Democrats It's getting messy on both sides.
Yes, it is.
All right, and our phone lines are open. We want to hear from you. Do you vote in a primary? Why or why not? And what are you looking for when you do it in this election? 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
Listen to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. And with me in this studio, if I can talk today, is Scott Braddock. He is the host of the Quorum Report radio podcast and also the editor of the Quorum Report. And you can call in with your questions and comments as we talk about the primary election. If you vote in a primary election or choose not to, we'd love to hear why. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. At the top of the Republican primary ballot, we have the race for U.S. Senate, and there is a field of, how many candidates we got? I'm pulling up my cheat sheet
Republicans
right now.
Three.
Oh, there's a lot there.
Well, there's three main people running.
There's three big ones. Mm-hmm. Okay, we have Ken Paxton, the current Attorney General. We mm-hmm. have John Cornyn, the incumbent U.S. Senator, and we have U.S. Congressman from Houston, Wesley Hunt. Everyone else is kind of really not breaking through on that. We'll see how that works out. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to play this is a campaign ad from Ken Paxton, the Ken Paxton ad, and this will tell you a lot about what's going on.
An attorney general who has really led the way, somebody who has been brave and strong, Ken Paxton.
It's going to take a patriot like Ken Paxton to make America great again.
He's very, very talented. He's a very talented guy.
And a really great attorney general.
Ken Paxton, tremendous guy.
I wish I had him in the White House with me.
The great Ken Paxton.
Ken Paxton for U.S. Senate.
I'm Ken Paxton, and I approve this message.
Of course he does.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, who wouldn't approve of the president saying all these nice things about you?
The MAGA guy himself, mm-hmm. Donald Trump, saying all these great things about Ken Paxton.
Right.
We're going to find out whether or not he actually has the endorsement of President Donald Trump. He does not. We're going to talk about that a little bit more. But next we'll go to, this is a campaign spot from the incumbent Senator John Cornyn.
Thank you, Senator Cornyn, for working with President Trump.
And for making Texas great again.
John Cornyn votes with President Trump 99% of the time.
He fights to put money back into hardworking families' pockets.
Families like mine.
He's securing our border with 18,000 new immigration agents.
And stopping our jobs from going overseas.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Cornyn, for always fighting for us.
Call Senator John Cornyn and thank him for standing with President Trump.
All right, that sounds like mm-hmm. he's got Trump's endorsement. I don't know. I'm confused now. Well, let's hear directly from President Trump. This is from him on Air Force One speaking to reporters.
A lot of Republicans in D.C. are asking you to endorse John Cornyn, but you haven't yet. Is there a chance you wouldn't endorse Paxton, and why haven't you endorsed Cornyn?
I just haven't made a decision on that race yet. It's got a ways to go, and I haven't. He's a good man. John is a good... I like all three of them, actually. I like all three. Those are the toughest races. They've all supported me. They're all good. And you're supposed to pick one. So we'll see what happens. But I support all three.
All right. So he's not giving an endorsement. He says, right. We got a ways to go. This was recorded yesterday, mm-hmm. I believe, or the day before.
Yeah, not that much of a ways to go.
No, there was.
Yeah, voting is starting now.
Yes. So it's, what do you make of that?
Well, a few things. He does like all three of them. Ken Paxton is the only attorney general in the whole country who would file that lawsuit for Trump to try to overturn the election in 2020. And he was there. Remember, think about who Paxton is as a national figure.
On January 6th.
He was there on J6, pumping up the crowd before the insurrection there. Wes Hunt, there was some chatter out of Houston and D.C. That Hunt was rumored to be one of Trump's potential choices for Secretary of Defense as a military man and all that. He really likes Wes Hunt. And with Cornyn, he likes him too. It's not just that, Cornyn's been a good vote for him. All those advertisements say, he votes with President Trump 99%. The ad could go further. It could say when he was the Republican whip in the Senate, he was the one helping to gather all the people up to vote for Trump's stuff, his legislation, and for his appointees to the federal bench, etc. There was a race, I think it was in Missouri, a Republican primary for U.S. Senate, where both of the candidates just happened to be named Eric. And Trump was, and he, you know, he liked both the candidates there too, and he didn't want to, you know, make anybody angry. And it was a similar thing. They asked him on Air Force One or wherever he was, they said, who do you like in that race? And Trump just said, no joke, he said, I'm with Eric all the way. And he just walked off. And then both of those campaigns used that in their ads to say, oh, Trump's with us. Here's one thing I think it speaks to is a sickness right now within for my friends in the Republican Party. And I have many friends who are Republicans, and a lot of them acknowledge this. It's a sad thing that almost the only thing that matters in the race is whether Trump would endorse one of the people. And let me give you an example. This happened in a Texas House race last year. And you remember that President Trump was making some select endorsements. Some of those candidates who Governor Abbott was mad about over the school voucher issue. There was one candidate out in Taylor County in Abilene. I was told that this incumbent Republican was leading his GOP challenger. Right about the same time as early voting was starting, this candidate was leading his challenger by about 10 to 12 points in their internal poll. Trump endorsed the challenger on the day of or the day before early voting started, right there at the end. And on election day, 2 weeks later, the race was virtually tied. The actual election result, it moved the candidate by about 10 points. That this candidate then finished and the challenger lost, but the race tightened up to where on election day, the result was 51-49. And that's how potent that endorsement is in a Republican primary.
I'm going to go to a caller and see what Coco has to say. Coco, you're on the air.
Hi, David. I agree with you both totally that voting in the primary is one of the most important things you can do, no matter which primary you want to vote in. But I have to disagree with you, David. It is important that you vote and know who you're voting for, and there's a way to do that. You go to the League of Women Voters, which is a nonpartisan group, and they publish a voter's guide. You can get it online at lwvtexas.org, and they ask all of the candidates, whichever office it is, the same questions, and they print all the replies. For instance, in the Republican primary, the ones that are running for Senate, they send them all the same questions, and they publish all the replies to the questions. And they go all the way down to your local level. So if there's somebody like in my district, we have a representative that's running, and I want to know, you know, there's two of them, and they answer the questions differently, and I look at that, and I decide which one I want to vote for, depending on how they answer the questions.
Well, that's great. Hopefully people can do that. I just think that if people aren't able to do that, they should not feel like they shouldn't vote, that they at least can vote for the candidates that they do know and exercise you don't have to vote in every single race. So yes, Coco, you are correct. We have our own voter's guide here at TPR.
Oh yeah.
And, it's something, and the League of Women Voters, big fan. You know, my mother was president of the San Antonio League of Women Voters when I was growing up.
So I didn't know that. That's
and,
cool.
Yeah, so
the League of Women
so
Voters.
So, Coco,
is
thank
great.
You so much for calling in and making that point. So, not all candidates will actually answer those questionnaires.
True.
But and so, in some ways, there's an effort to not give us information what the candidates really think or what they and avoid these events like. What happened with the debate between John Cornyn and Ken Paxton?
Oh, yeah, they didn't have one.
No debate between these two major political figures.
Cornyn didn't want to have one. Wes Hunt, that third candidate in the race that we mentioned, the congressman from Houston, he had been challenging Cornyn and Paxton to debate as well. Cornyn has given many interviews where he said he's not going to debate him because he can't, quote, can't win. And, you know, this goes way back in Texas at this point. It seems like recent history, but we've had a couple decades under our belt now of top Republicans not debating their opponents. Remember when Rick Perry wouldn't debate Bill White going back to 2006, 2010. You know, this is something that those in power don't want to engage in or They'll have debates that are in very controlled environments. I'll say it that way, where the candidates are restricted to 30-second or one-minute answers. It doesn't really give you a lot of information.
And I think that these candidates feel like they don't have to go and do a debate if they don't want to, because the voters don't hold them accountable. Voters won't say, well, you didn't debate. I didn't get a chance to hear your views on my issues. I didn't hear you do a fair exchange against your opponent. And apparently in this environment in Texas, that doesn't matter.
It doesn't. And we've had, you know, such a change in the media landscape, right? I can remember, and you can remember, a time when those candidates like Rick Perry, who I mentioned, or like Governor Abbott, they would not only do interviews that were in what I would call friendly media, where they're only going to be asked questions that basically set them up to talk about whatever they want. So, for example, Lieutenant Governor Patrick or the governor right now, they like to appear on Fox News Channel, Newsmax, OANN.
Very friendly media.
Conservative talk radio show hosts will just kind of lob softballs at them.
No follow-ups,
and they get to say basically whatever they want to say. There's a reason you have an adversarial press, and I can remember a time when top Texas politicians could do both. Rick Perry would go on Fox News Channel, but he would also, you know, go talk to the Houston Chronicle, or he would talk to us when I worked at CBS News up in Dallas, and had no problem with that. And you just don't see as much of that anymore.
Yeah, and we do extend invitations to Republican candidates and office holders quite frequently, and we don't really get a response. Or if we get a response, it's frequently no. When people are critical of us not having enough Republican voices on the air, it's not for our lack of trying. We have an open door policy. If there's a Republican office holder or leading candidate who wants to get on the air, we'd love to have you. I did invite Wesley Hunt to come on, and no response. So that's how the cow ate the cabbage.
On that, yeah.
On that. Oh, back to this really quickly about the power of the endorsement of Donald Trump and how that keeps Republican lawmakers in Congress in line. And we've seen this with the Congressional District 23. This is the district that runs along the U.S. border from down to San Antonio and over to El Paso. It's currently held by Tony Gonzalez. Mm-hmm. And he is counting on having the endorsement of Donald Trump.
Sure.
And he has been a big defender of ICE and these detention centers. Mm-hmm. When his main opponent, Brandon Herrera, who gave him a scare 2 years ago.
Oh, the AK guy.
The AK guy. That is not a pejorative. That is what he calls himself. He started using Donald Trump in his campaign material. He received a cease and desist letter from the Donald Trump people saying, you can't use it. We don't want anything to do with you. And so that is that story.
Well, yeah, I mean, they fight about who's the most Trumpy, if you will. They fight about who's the most MAGA. And, you know, the challenge for a lot of Republicans, particularly in South Texas, is that President Trump can add to their numbers and help them defend themselves in a primary, but he can't add anything for their numbers in the general election, right? And so you know that for some of these seats that were redrawn in that mid-decade redistricting last year, very controversial, that those are competitive seats. They're not necessarily just Republican seats. They are drawn to perform for Republicans in a good year for Republicans. They used the numbers from the 2024 election to draw those districts. That was a great year for Republicans, a terrible year for Democrats. I don't know that this year is going to be great for Republicans, right? And there are a lot of reasons to think that it won't be. But if you look at where those endorsements are coming down in South Texas, Tony Gonzalez, like you mentioned, also Eric Flores down in the Valley. And it seems to me that what the White House is doing is, in a lot of these races, but not in the U.S. Senate race here, for whatever reason, which we were talking about, but in these congressional races, they've gotten very smart about trying to put the president's stamp of approval on the candidates who polls show are their best candidate for November. So in that Tony Gonzalez seat, it's Gonzalez, not Herrera. In that seat down in the Valley, it's a candidate named Eric Flores, who's running against Myra Flores, the former congresswoman from down in Brownsville. And one of them is going to take on Congressman Vicente Gonzalez in the fall. Flores is hands down, Eric Flores. They both have the same last name, but there's no relation. But Eric Flores is hands down the better candidate by the numbers to take on Congressman Gonzalez. And the way that one of the Republican consultants in the Valley said it to me, they said, you know, Congressman Vicente Gonzalez, he's only running because he might get Myra Flores as his opponent. He would just wipe the floor with her. But this consultant did not say that Eric Flores would just beat him outright. What they said was, if it's Eric Flores, then it's a real race. And that's why the White House would get behind him.
Right. And that gets to the point we were making earlier, is the primary system doesn't always get the best candidate to the polls, to the ballot in November. And that goes both ways with the Democrats and the Republicans, which is why it's in the best interest for everyone if political independents, people who aren't extremists, people who are moderates, vote in the primary. We're going to take a break here. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about the Democratic side of that U.S. Senate seat and that campaign. We got James Tallarico and Jasmine Crockett. We can talk about that. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me in the studio, Scott Braddock. He's the editor of The Quorum Report. He has a podcast called Quorum Report Radio, where he covers inside Texas politics, stuff that you won't hear anyplace else. You can get that on your podcast app. Mm-hmm. So right now, let's get on to the other side of the ticket, the Democrats, and how things are going for the U.S. Senate seat. We have two main candidates running for that. One is the Texas State Representative James Tallarico and Congressmember Jasmine Crockett. Mm-hmm. James Tallarico was not on the TV with Colbert last night.
Right.
And we're going to find out more about that. But here is what Colbert and Tallarico, what their exchange was like.
FCC opening probe into The View after appearance by Tallarico. Do you mean to cause trouble?
I think that Donald Trump is worried that we're about to flip Texas. And Stephen, this is the party that ran against cancel culture. And now they're trying to control what we watch, what we say, what we read. And this is the most dangerous kind of cancel culture, the kind that comes from the top. They went after The View because I went on there. They went after Jimmy Kimmel for telling a joke they didn't like. They went after you for telling the truth about Paramount's bribe to Donald Trump. Corporate media executives are selling out the First Amendment to curry favor with corrupt politicians. And a threat to any of our First Amendment rights is a threat to all of our First Amendment rights.
So Scott Braddock, that did not get on the air. That was just on their YouTube channel, but it's made all of the press, and it's probably going to get a million clicks.
Easily.
So this is the kind of earned media, as we say in the biz. You didn't buy this campaign ad, but it is actually kind of priceless. So what do you make of that?
Absolutely. I mean, it probably will get more views because it was, quote unquote, banned from TV. And I would say, I'm only half joking when I say this, only the Trump administration coupled with CBS News ownership could be incompetent enough to turn a pretty boring boilerplate interview into something that is seen as too hot for TV, right? He's right about the things he's saying, of course. They shouldn't be telling the FCC in the past has not cracked down on broadcasters in this way, and we didn't have a major media player willing to go along with it in the same way as CBS is doing right now.
They've canonized him. They've given him a lot of...
It could not be better timed, and I will say that Tallarico, whether it was his appearance on Joe Rogan or what we're talking about now with Colbert, he and his team have done a masterful job of earning media. And here's one thing to know about that is they're playing a lot of catch up in earned media with his opponent, Jasmine Crockett, who is excellent at it, right? She's the one who rolled out her campaign with a TV ad that the first video was just her face. And all you would hear was the president's voice bad-mouthing her because she clashes with Donald Trump all the time. She has had those earned media moments where she fought with Marjorie Taylor Greene, the now-retired congresswoman who's a lightning rod. And just this past week, She was one of the stars of the Pam Bondi hearing, where Representative Crockett, you know, at the beginning of her comments, said that she wasn't even going to ask Bondi any questions. She was just going to rail against her because she said that Bondi wasn't answering the questions anyway. So both of these people, Crockett and Tallarico, very talented at that earned media and getting that kind of attention, quote unquote, for free for their campaigns. But only Tallarico has really engaged in a lot of actual campaign spending. Right now, he is outspending Crockett something like 17-1. And he has been a prolific fundraiser, to his credit. You know, he's raised something like $20 million so far, whereas Crockett has raised a smaller amount. And both of them are, I would say, pretty healthy fundraisers. But I was a little surprised, I'll give them credit, a little surprised at how much Tallarico is able to raise. And a lot of it is because of his social media following. He has something like, he started the campaign with at least 2 million followers on Instagram.
He started with zero name recognition.
That's right. And that's the thing. Social, you know how people always say, social media isn't real life? You know how people say that? What I would say is a little different. Social media is part of real life, right? He had 2 million Instagram followers, and what he's able to do with that is ask those followers who are from here in Texas, but all around the country as well. He can ask them for $2, $5, $10, small donations that add up to a lot, and he's been able to do that with great success and really try to build that name ID. But a lot of this polling still shows that Representative Crockett, if you had to bet today, it would still probably be just in her favor right now, and might win a race by 5 or 6 points, but we still have, you know, 2-3 weeks left to go.
Well, I want to play some sound. This is from Congressmember Jasmine Crockett from yesterday, giving a speech at a anti-President's Day event protesting Donald Trump in the Dallas area. You can hear in what she talks about how she is kind of, you know, feeling the heat from all of the national attention that James Tallarico is getting. Let's give a listen.
And a lot of people ask, why, Congresswoman, why would you run for the United States Senate in the state of Texas? Why? Texans haven't won in 30 years. Why would you do that? We need your voice on the federal level. Well, I'm telling you right now, you will have my voice so long as you do what you're supposed to do and show up to the polls. Now, more importantly, there are so many people that don't believe in Texas, yet everybody got an opinion about what's going on in Texas. I've never seen so many people out of New York and D.C. deciding to weigh in on Texas politics when allegedly it doesn't matter. I can tell you that Texas has always been at the epicenter of doing what is right until recent years. LBJ came from the state of Texas. LBJ signed the Voting Rights Act into law. LBJ signed the Civil Rights Act into law. Do you know where Roe v. Wade initiated? It initiated right there in Texas 30. That set the world on fire. Women finally were getting some semblance of equity in this country, and it was led by Texas. Do you know the last governor that we had that was a Democrat in the state of Texas? Ann Richards. That's right. So let me tell you something. Texas has a rich history of doing what's right.
So what do you make of the points that Jasmine Crockett was making there, Scott Braddock?
You know, it's true that Texas is, she's saying that Texas has a history of doing things that are right. I would add to that, and it's true, but I would add to that that Texas also has a history of only recently being a Republican state, right? I mean, people have gone a generation now without seeing a Republican elected statewide.
It's been 30 years.
My daughter has never even known that that was a thing. Or the producer of my podcast, who's 26, he would have no idea what that looks like. But I think there's sort of might think of it as an imagination gap. When you have some of those old hands at Texas politics, I would say the veterans out there, like my publisher, who is 75 years old just a week ago. Happy birthday, Harvey. You know, he can remember a time, and he covered it when you had Democrats and Republicans competitive statewide. And as someone who is 45 and will be 46 this year, I've never really covered that and I've been doing this a long time. You know, more than 25 years, and it's always been Republicans winning. So what you kind of have is those younger people who are, you know, jazzed up and amped up about Tallarico or Crockett, and they have the hope, because it hasn't been beaten out of them yet, that we would have a competitive race in Texas. Or put this way, for a lot of young Democrats, the most inspiring campaign they've ever seen is one that they still lost to Ted Cruz. That was Beto O'Rourke in 2018. But they can still imagine that it might happen. Folks like me, I've been around long enough to think, who knows? We'll see at some point, I guess. I'll believe it when I see it. I'll cover it if it happens, right? But then you had those folks who had seen it before, so they can see it maybe happening again. And look, I think that one thing that you got to consider in this primary is the electability question. This is right. What Tallarico keeps bringing this up, and his campaign supporters keep bringing this up as well. They talk about the idea that he's the one who really has the shot to put together the multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multi-generational coalition that a Democrat needs to put together to even be competitive in Texas. And Tallarico's supporters claim that Crockett can't do that, that she can basically appeal to the base of the Democratic Party, as was said this morning after the passing of the Reverend Jesse Jackson. It's that black voter, and in particular the black female voter, that is the backbone of the Democratic Party, even here in Texas, right? But they need all these other groups too. And so think about the fact that here in San Antonio, I'm fascinated by this. So many analysts seem to think that the only candidate who can put together that coalition is a white candidate, because that person might not necessarily be offensive to the black or brown factions within the Democratic Party. But isn't it interesting that in San Antonio, countywide and citywide, y'all keep electing Asians around here? Isn't that, I mean, has anybody really dug into the politics of it? Well, think about it. It's sort of this other category that's not immediately offensive to African-American voters or the Latino voters in a Latino majority place, right? And so, look, I think what this race may come down to isn't so much the electability question. I'm trying to think and tell y'all about what I'm hearing from voters all over the state right now. What I hear everywhere I go, here in Bexar County, in DFW, Houston, the Valley, if you're talking to Democrats, what do they want? They want a fighter. And polls show, internal polls of campaigns and some of the public polling shows, that the number one issue for Democrats is what? It's basically fighting Trump. It's fighting Republican extremism or fighting MAGA, right?
And but on the Republican side, you can't fight if you can't win.
That's right. And on the Republican side, they kind of suffer from the same thing. They just want a fighter, which is why you very well could see Ken Paxton, who's the least electable, at least by the numbers. He could be the nominee for the Republicans, but he's seen as the fighter. And Crockett could be the nominee because she's seen as the fighter, but she's also, according to polls, not as likely to win in November. So you potentially have a case where the two people out of the 31 million people in Texas, it's the only two people who could possibly lose to each other, will be the nominees in November.
Well, we'll talk about that when we come back from the break. We do want to hear from our listeners, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. How important is electability to you, or should we just focus on the issues, ideology, these other issues? You know, what is it all about? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're hashing out the primary election ballot. With me in the studio, Scott Braddock, the editor of The Quorum Report, and he's the host of The Quorum Report radio podcast. And you can call in with your questions and comments. Do you vote in the primaries or do you not? Why is that? And if you vote, you know, do you think about electability? Do you wonder, like, I'm going to vote for the candidate most likely to win in November, even though this is not the candidate that I really support? Give us a call. We'd love to hear your take. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Let's go to Ann. Ann, you're on the air. Go ahead, Ann.
Thanks. I just wanted to make sure everyone out there knew that the League of Women Voters, both in San Antonio and nationally, have a website. It's vote411.org. You can put in your address. There's a spot to put in your address, and your ballot will come up. Now, in Bexar County, the San Antonio League of Women Voters ask questions of all the candidates, depending on what they're running for. And if they answer, they will be there on that vote411.org. They'll be there unedited, bad punctuation, poor spelling, whatever it is, it will be there.
We all need editors.
It's a good way to try and decide who you want.
Me most.
I'm sorry.
We all need an editor.
Me most of all. Yeah. Even it's my title, I still need an editor.
Yeah. All right. Well, and thank you so much for reminding us about the important work that the League of Women Voters does.
Well, can I defend David for a nonpartisan
organization dedicated to just educating voters.
Well, I was going to say, can I defend the host for just a second? I don't think that you said to anybody that they shouldn't vote or they shouldn't be informed when they go to the polls. You are trying to encourage, you know, people to be good citizens, right? So, of course, if people are going to go vote, they should get educated about it. But that's not always what we see, but it is what they should do.
Talking about endorsements earlier, Governor Greg Abbott, he loves to make endorsements sometimes full-throated. He's going to really go out there and make endorsements.
Sure.
But he got involved in the agriculture commissioner.
Oh, yes.
And it's really interesting. Sid Miller has been the agriculture commissioner for a while. Mm-hmm. But he's the incumbent, and usually Republicans stick with the incumbent. But now Greg Abbott has gone with Nate Sheetz. Mm-hmm. You moderated a debate between mm-hmm. these two. What is up with that?
Well, a couple of weeks ago in Houston, I did moderate a debate between Commissioner Miller and Sheetz. And for the most part in that, they talked about issues that are important to Republican voters, including the Make America Healthy push and all of that. Sheetz is one of these, you know, his company is an organic honey company. So he talks about getting rid of pesticides, getting rid of all the chemicals in our foods and all that kind of stuff, which is resonating with Republican voters now. Isn't it interesting that they made fun of Michelle Obama when she pushed that stuff when the Obamas were in the White House? But this the campaign has turned really nasty here in the last couple of weeks. And it seems to me that the governor is doing a lot of talking, but he's not really doing anything. He's not putting his political machine to work for his endorsed candidates in this race or in the race for Texas comptroller. In that race, he's supporting Kelly Hancock. In this race where he's supporting Nate Sheetz, you may have seen Governor Abbott, and we played the audio of this on Quorum Report Radio. Abbott was told my friend Mark Davis, a conservative host up in Dallas, that Commissioner Miller is corrupt and has connections to criminality. Of course, the governor didn't say this, but what he's talking about is the chief of staff to Miller was indicted in Travis County, accused of shaking down farmers for hemp licenses, right? So he did take a plea deal on that. But just this weekend.
I mean, this is hot.
That's one side of it.
This is hot. If you have children in the car, turn down the radio.
Yeah, well, on the other side of it, I'll do the radio version of this. A headline yesterday at QuorumReport.com, the Abbott-backed candidate for Texas Agriculture Commissioner opens up on the campaign trail talking about his alcoholism, porn addiction, and an extramarital affair. And what this was, that you have a guy in Nate Sheetz who has been in the Christian ministry. He worked for a while at an organization called I Am Second, which is a very popular Christian ministry. And while he was at one of these Christian ministries, he did have an extramarital affair. And he did open up on a series of podcasts and talk about his struggles with those things that I mentioned. And, you know, this is something that's pretty common in Baptist ministry. You would see these stories of redemption of people who used to be an ex-con, the ex-felon. I remember in the First Baptist Church, El Campo, Texas, where I grew up, they would have a guy from East Texas come in with one of those white t-shirts that's got like a tuxedo printed on the front, that kind of thing. And this guy would be an ex-felon, and he just came from East Texas, and he just needs to stall past the collection plate so he can get his church started, you know, out in Lufkin or wherever. So that's not uncommon. But it seems to me that Sheetz did something that is a rookie mistake for a first-time candidate, which he is. What he did was he kind of took the bait when some of the opposition research against him was starting to be floated out there. Get this. There was a website that popped up over the weekend called, you can't make this stuff up, but it's Texas politics. There was a website called SoiledSheetz.com. Where it featured a bunch of these, audio clips from these podcasts where Sheetz has talked about all of this.
But this
stuff
is for agriculture commissioner, which really a significant position.
Absolutely,
and agriculture is suffering in Texas. Yeah. I want to move on to.
I got to finish that. Though one thing, the mistake he made was talking about it in a debate this weekend when no one had asked him about it. Right. The voters who were in the room didn't even know what he was talking about. He opened up and said, "Oh, yeah, I've had all these struggles, and it's part of my walk with Christ."
All right, the comptroller.
Yeah.
That's a big office these days.
Mm-hmm.
Don Huffines, he's a perennial Republican candidate. He was a former state senator.
Yes, sir.
Ran for governor 4 years ago and pushed Abbott to the right. What's going on with him and Jeffrey Epstein?
So former Senator Huffines, it was just revealed in a newspaper in New Mexico that he owns the Zorro Ranch, which was, an infamous property owned by Jeffrey Epstein at the center of the Epstein files. And this news dropped right before early voting on, I think it was Thursday or Friday, that this link to this story in the New Mexico newspaper about it was being sent to political professionals in Austin. Didn't really know what to make of it at first. One of the folks I follow in media said that it was like a 3-ton bomb that was dropped in the middle of this race. And it connects, in a way, former Senator Huffines to Jeffrey Epstein. The spokesman for Huffines' campaign, Alan Blakemore from Houston, had said that, look, this was purchased long after any of the untoward stuff happened with Epstein, and that money from the purchase eventually flowed to victims of Epstein, right? So that's their story. That's their version.
Okay, well, there is something really important that needs to happen at that ranch now. What's going on there? They need to be doing some digging.
Sure, and there's some investigations.
Literal digging into the ground.
Yeah, that folks want to see that. And again, from the Huffines campaign, they said they will cooperate with any of that, anything that needs to happen.
Right, the governor of New Mexico has said this is going to happen.
Yeah, and I think the political consequence for Senator Huffines is that he has built his political career based on support from a lot of folks who spread and share these conspiracy theories about Jeffrey Epstein, right? And we're very angry at President Trump for not doing what he said he was going to do on the Epstein files, which was, what did Trump say he was going to do? Release them on day one. And of course, then they did this tap dance forever. And then, as you have pointed out, they voted in Congress to finally do that, but a lot of Republicans did not support that.
Republican in Congress
voted for that. Yeah.
Voted to release the Epstein files when they had the special vote, and only four or five Republicans voted with all Democrats. So every Republican in Congress from Texas voted to keep those files from coming out. I just wonder, will voters care?
I think they do, and I think that this race helps to test that because, as I said, Senator Huffines has built his politics, his political operation, on support from those folks who identify with someone like Carrie Lake, for example, who is one of these conspiracy theorists who ran for governor. Where was that? In Arizona.
And Senator.
And so, in a way, one of the Republican operatives I was talking to yesterday said that this story sort of it further splinters different factions. It factions the factions, if you will. Some of those MAGA conspiracy theorists might now back away from Huffines because even if it can be shown that what his campaign is saying is true, the conspiracy theorists won't believe that. They'll think that, no, there must be something more untoward here. And so it does cause a mess for some. And I'll say this just in a straightforward way. For someone who is not a first-time candidate, has been running for office since he ran for Senate years ago, 10 years ago, then ran for governor, now is running for comptroller. Just politically, you might think that you might know better than to do that, that it would be political kryptonite for a candidate to own a ranch that is situated in this way.
But I think we got to have campaigns. Mm-hmm. These candidates can't hide forever. Eventually, they have to go out and meet the public and try and get votes. So these Republican incumbent members of Congress who voted not to release the Epstein files, I think that the standing question needs to be, from the media and anyone else, needs to be, why did you do that? Why didn't you vote to release these files? Why did you vote to cover up the Epstein files? It was not a hoax. It is real. And the people should know, and there should be justice about this entire episode. Why did you vote to cover it up, Congressman? We need to know.
It's very important. And again, it is the only thing that shakes the MAGA base away from Trump, because he had promised them that those files would come out immediately. And it's not just that promise. If you think about it bigger picture, what Trump built his support on in this last election and the election in 2016, one of the big themes of his campaign is that he and his supporters and the people who worked on his campaign, like Roger Stone, Steve Bannon, they tell a story to the American people about how there's this elite class that you're not part of, right? That's what they tell their supporters, and we're going to be in your corner. And then as soon as he's in office, what does Trump do? He sides with that elite Epstein class, and that's why a lot of the MAGA folks think he's, they think he's full of it about this
issue. And they think the MAGA has run its course.
Some do, yeah.
All right, Scott Braddock, he is the editor of the Quorum Report, and he is the host of Quorum Report Radio Podcast. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.